Starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We think of Halloween as the traditional time for ghost stories. But ghost stories have been very popular around the winter solstice for ages. Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, published in 1843, is probably the most famous. You surely have heard the tale about how Ebenezer Scrooge was haunted by ghosts. Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale talks of sprites and goblins. Well, Mrs. J.H. Riddle, aka Charlotte Riddle, who lived from 1832 to 1906, was a popular Irish-born Victorian writer who wrote 56 works and was known for her ghost stories. In today's show, we feature J.H. Riddle's A Strange Christmas Game. Also stories and poems from local favorites Sherry Cohen, Julie Rico, and Sarah Murphy, and a bunch of fun Christmas music in between. Big thanks to Sarah Murphy for helping me produce this show. Stay tuned!
Melikilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day and all the stars at night. Melikilikimaka is a wise way to say Merry Christmas to you.
Melikilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day and all the stars at night. Melikilikimaka is Hawaii's way to say Merry Christmas to you. Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day and all the stars at night.
Melikilikimaka is a wise way
to say Merry Christmas to you. Melikilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway.
Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright.
The sun to shine by day and all the stars at night.
Melikalikimaka is a wise way to say Merry Christmas.
A very Merry Christmas.
A very, very Merry, Merry Christmas to you.
So I'm Jewish, but this isn't about Hanukkah. It's about Christmas, because I love Christmas. Every year I get the same question, but you're Jewish, how can you enjoy Christmas? And I used to answer that it's the same way you can enjoy celebrating Hanukkah with your Jewish friends. But that got me blank stares, because anyone asking that question probably doesn't celebrate other people's holidays. Then last year I saw a meme that provided a much better answer. It's like celebrating someone else's birthday. It's not your birthday, but you can still enjoy the party. And who doesn't love a birthday party, other than introverts? Not only am I Jewish, but I grew up in Southern California. So I could dream of a white Christmas, but it's nothing like the one I used to know. When I was a kid, we'd go to Disneyland on Christmas, and it would be empty and totally decked out. They do such a great Christmas that now it's one of their busiest days of the year. So the Jewish secret is out. And then when I got older, I used to offer to work on Christmas, even take extra shifts so that people could be home with their families. Man, you get some serious appreciation that way, even though it wasn't really a sacrifice. Everyone would be in a good mood and all the bosses were at home. We got away with so much stuff. Thank God there was no YouTube in those days. I married a Goy and now we go to raise family for Christmas. So it's still like someone else's birthday party, but now it's like someone in the family. So have yourself a merry little Christmas, or a big Christmas, or Jewish Christmas, which is Chinese food in the movie. And if you want to celebrate Hanukkah with me, sorry, you're too late for this year. It came really early and it's already over. But hit me up for Passover this spring. I make a mean matzo ball soup.
No, there won't be Christmas for me this year. For the simple reason, being you're not here. There won't be eggnogs by the cozy fire. There won't be glasses of mulled wine either. There won't even be a Christmas tree, 'cause you're not here to light it up with me. Santa, honey, won't you bring my baby back to me? 'Cause I miss him, yes, I miss him, oh, so dearly. I haven't sent him his Christmas card, 'cause that will mean we really are. The Christmas stockings are as empty as my heart. I know you're away doing something good, but just this once, baby, if you could. You know you can and you know you should, 'cause Christmas won't be Christmas without you. It won't be Christmas without you. To Christmas and I'm still waiting outside, wishing upon a star that you'll be coming home tonight. But it was cold, it was getting late. Sadly I crept back into bed, but then I felt a soft kiss on my cheek. I opened my eyes and there my baby was with me. My baby came back for me. Merry Christmas, baby. Merry Christmas, baby. Merry Christmas.
All I Want for Christmas by Julie Rico. Children and adults experience Christmas very differently. As an adult, I don't believe in Santa Claus. I am no longer in a place where the Christmas fantasy is real. And no one around me is trying to make me believe in Santa Claus. As an existentialist, Christmas is a problem for me. Well, actually, now that I think about it, Christmas has nothing to do with existentialism. But anyway, I don't want to spend, buy. I would instead like to give gifts to people when I feel they deserve a gift, or when I feel like giving them a gift. Generosity should and can exist in our lives daily. I like giving my energy to people. I wish I had more energy to give. Last Christmas, at my part-time boyfriend's parents' opulent home, everyone gathered. I was ready with my thoughtful gifts. Then no one had a gift for me. It was almost funny when everyone passed out the gifts and I had none. Well, my boyfriend's mom hastily put together some chips, some soap she had bought at the grocery store, and something that looked like a gift from a corporate event she attended. She's sweet, and I love her. I have to give her a pass on the hasty gift. At least she tried. My part-time boyfriend came through the night before with a nice piece of jewelry. I didn't feel like a total loser at Christmas. Christmas was huge in my mind when I was a kid. It was fantastic to believe in Santa Claus. I believed. The anticipation of a fat, white-bearded man coming down the chimney with gifts made me feel giddy. The cookies and milk we left out were the least we could do for what Santa would bring us in the morning. When I was that pie-eyed kid, the holidays were special for my family in Michigan. For years, we rented a VFW hall to hold all my relatives for a giant Christmas party. Oh, how wonderful to smell the marshmallowy ambrosia salad, taste the corn laden with spicy braised pork tamales made by my grandmother, to scoop a plop of the crunchy potato salad made by my Aunt Lily, and the deviled eggs made by Aunt Mary. The ham brought by Aunt Marge, she was German. The turkey made by Uncle Jesse. The pot roast studded with garlic and comino seeds made by Mom. There were always frijoles, tortillas, and Spanish rice, besides macaroni salad, chicken and mole. A green salad held a place at the end of the long table, next to the chocolate sheet cake, the white cake, the pumpkin pies, the apple pies, and the lemon meringue pies, and what seemed like 5,000 Christmas cookies. So much food, I felt rich. We danced before the feast and after, and the mix of Mexican music and Motown and the Beatles stirred our energies. I still remember those Christmases in Michigan with my family. The food, no gifts. It was about us, our family, together. Christmas has been swallowed whole by the idea that conspicuous consumption is what matters. And we learn this as kids. Please, someone, all I want for Christmas this year is a good bottle of tequila.
Like a bowl of jelly roll. Whoa! Fucking Christmas. Christmas lights. Miss Claus got the phone. Nutcracker got the phone. Oh yeah. Gingerbread Man got the phone. Even me, Mr. Grinch got the phone. Oh yeah. I said Jack Frost got the phone. Drummer Boy got the phone. Oh yeah. Toy Soldier got the phone. That Sugar Plum Fairy got funk in the trunk. Christmas lights.
A Strange Christmas Game by J.H. Riddle, 1863. When through the death of a distant relative, I, John Lester, succeeded to the Martindale estate, there could not have been found in the length and breadth of England a happier pair than myself and my only sister, Claire. We were not such utter hypocrites as to affect sorrow for the loss of our kinsman, Paul Lester, a man we had never seen, of whom we had heard but little, and that little unfavorable, at whose hands we had never received a single benefit, who was, in short, as great a stranger to us as the then Prime Minister, the Emperor of Russia, or any other human being utterly removed from our extremely humble sphere of life. His loss was very certainly our gain. His death represented to us not a dreary parting from one long loved and highly honored, but the accession of lands, houses, consideration, wealth to myself, John Lester, Esquire, Martindale, Bedfordshire, Willem Jack Lester, artist and second floor lodger at 32 Great Smith Street, Bloomsbury. Not that Martindale was much of an estate as county properties go. The Lesters, who had succeeded to that domain from time to time during the course of a few hundred years, could by no stretch of courtesy have been called prudent men. In regard to their posterity, they were indeed scarcely honest, for they parted with manors and farms, with common rights and advesens, in a manner at once so baronial and so unbusinesslike that Martindale, at length in the hands of Jeremy Lester, the last resident owner, melted to a mere little dot in the map of Bedfordshire. Concerning this Jeremy Lester, there was a mystery. No man could say what had become of him. He was in the oak parlor at Martindale one Christmas Eve, and before the next morning, he had disappeared, to reappear in the flesh no more. Overnight, Mr. Worley, a great friend and boon companion of Jeremy's, had sat playing cards with him until 12 o'clock chimed. Then he took leave of his host and rode home under the moonlight. After that, no person, as far as could be ascertained, ever saw Jeremy Lester alive. His ways of life had not been either the most regular or the most respectable, and it was not until a new year had come in without any tidings of his whereabouts reaching the house that his servants became seriously alarmed concerning his absence. Then inquiries were set on foot concerning him, inquiries which grew more urgent as weeks and months passed by, without the slightest clue being obtained as to his whereabouts. Rewards were offered, advertisements inserted, but still Jeremy made no sign. And so in the course of time, the heir-at-law, Paul Lester, took possession of the house and went down to spend the summer months at Martindale with his rich wife and her four children by a first husband. Paul Lester was a barrister, an overworked barrister, who everyone supposed would be glad enough to leave the bar and settle in Martindale, where his wife's money and the fortune he had accumulated could not have failed to give him a good standing even among the neighboring county families. And perhaps it was with some intention that he went down to Bedfordshire. If this were so, however, he speedily changed his mind, for with the January snows he returned to London, let off the land surrounding the house, shut up the hall, put in a caretaker, and never troubled himself further about his ancestral seat. Time went on, and people began to say the house was haunted, that Paul Lester had seen something, and so forth. All which stories were duly repeated for our benefit, when, 41 years after the disappearance of Jeremy Lester, Claire and I went down to inspect our inheritance. I say our, because Claire had stuck bravely to me in poverty, grinding poverty, and prosperity was not going to part us now. What was mine was hers, and that she knew, God bless her, without my needing to tell her so. The transition from rigid economy to comparative wealth was in our case the more delightful also because we had not in the least degree anticipated it. We never expected Paul Lester's shoes to come to us, and accordingly, it was not upon our conscience that we had ever in our dreariest moods wished him dead. Had he made a will, no doubt we should have never gone to Martindale, and I consequently never written this story. But luckily for us, he died intestate, and the Bedfordshire property came to me. As for his fortune, he had spent it in traveling and in giving great entertainments at his grand house in the Portman Square. Concerning his effects, Mrs. Lester and I came to a very amicable agreement, and she did me the honor of inviting me to call upon her occasionally and, as I heard, spoke of me as a very worthy and presentable young man for the station, which, of course, coming from so good an authority, was gratifying. Moreover, she asked me if I intended residing at Martindale, and on my replying in the affirmative, hope I should like it. It struck me at the time that there was a certain significance in her tone. I felt confident that if Mrs. Lester had hoped much, she feared more. People said Mr. Jeremy walked at Martindale. He had been seen, it was averred, by poachers, by gameskeepers, by children who had come to use the park as a near cut to school, by lovers who kept their trysts under the elms and beeches. As for the caretaker and his wife, the third in residence since Jeremy Lester's disappearance, the man gravely shook his head when questioned, while the woman stated that wild horses, or even wealth untold, should not draw her into the red bedroom, nor into the oak parlor after dark. I have heard my mother tell, sir, it was her as followed old Miss Reynolds, the first caretaker, how there were things went on in those self-same rooms as might make any Christian's heir stand on end. Such stamping and swearing and knocking about of furniture, and then tramp, 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 the great staircase and along the corridor, and so into the red bedroom, and then bang, and tramp, tramp again. They do say, sir, Mr. Paul Lester met him once, and from that time the oak parlor has never been opened. I never was inside it myself. Upon hearing which fact, the first thing I did was proceed to the oak parlor, open the shutters, and let the August sun stream in upon the haunted chamber. It was an old-fashioned, plainly furnished apartment, with a large table in the center, a smaller in a recess by the fireplace, chairs ranged about the walls, and a dusty, moth-eaten carpet on the floor. There were dogs on the hearth, broken and rusty. There was a brass fender tarnished and battered, a picture of some sea fight over the mantelpiece, while another work of art, about equal in merit, hung between the windows. Altogether an utterly prosaic and not uncheerful apartment, from out of which the ghosts flitted as soon as daylight was let into it, and which I proposed as soon as I felt my feet, to redecorate, refurnish, and convert into a pleasant morning room. I was still under 30, but I had learned prudence in that very good school, necessity, and it was not my intention to spend much money until I ascertained for certain what were the actual revenues derivable from the land still belonging to the Martindale estates and the charges upon them. In fact, I wanted to know what I was worth before committing myself to any great extravagance, and the place had for so long a time been neglected that I experienced some difficulty in arriving at the state of my real income. But in the meanwhile, Claire and I found great enjoyment in exploring every nook and corner of our domain, in turning over the contents of old chests and cupboards, in examining the faces of our ancestors looking down on us from the walls, in walking through the neglected gardens, full of weeds, overgrown with shrubs and birdweed, where the boxwood was 18 inches high and the shoots of the rose trees yards long. I have put the place in order since then. There is no grass on the paths. There are no trailing brambles over the ground. The hedges have been cut and trimmed, and the trees pruned and the boxwood clipped. But I often say nowadays that despite all of my improvements, or rather in consequence of them, Martindale does not look one half so pretty as it did in its pristine state of uncivilized picturesqueness. Although I determined not to commence repairing and decorating the house till better informed concerning the rental of Martindale, still, the state of my finances was so far satisfactory that Claire and I decided on going abroad and taking our long-talked of holiday before the fine weather was past. We could not tell what a year might bring forth, as Claire sagely remarked. It was wise to take our pleasure while we could, and accordingly, before the end of August arrived, we were wandering about the continent, loitering in Rouen, visiting the galleries in Paris, and talking of extending our 1 month of enjoyment to three. What decided me on this course was the circumstance of our becoming acquainted with an English family who intended wintering in Bourne. We met accidentally, but discovering we were near neighbors in England, in fact, that Mr. Cronson's property lay close beside Martindale, the slight acquaintance soon ripened into intimacy, and ere long we were traveling in company. From the first, Claire did not much like this arrangement. There was a little girl in England she wanted me to marry, and Mr. Cronson had a daughter who was certainly both handsome and attractive. The little girl had not despised John Lester, artist, while Miss Cronson indisputably set her cap at John Lester of Martindale, and would have turned away her pretty face from a poor man's admiring gaze. All this I can see plainly enough now, but I was blind then, and should have proposed to Mary Bell, that was her name, before the winter was over, had news not suddenly arrived of the illness of Mrs. Cronson Sr. In a moment, the program was changed. Our pleasant days of foreign travel were at an end. The Cronsons packed up and departed, while Claire and I returned more slowly to England, a little out of humor, it must be confessed, with each other. It was in the middle of November when we arrived at Martindale, and found the place anything but romantic or pleasant. The walks were wet and sodden. The trees were leafless. There were no flowers save a few late pink roses blooming in the garden. It had been a wet season and the place looked miserable. Claire would not ask Alice down to keep her company in the winter months, as she had intended, and for myself, the Cronsons were still absent in Norfolk, where they meant to spend Christmas with old Miss Cronson, now recovered. Altogether, Martindale seemed dreary enough, and the ghost stories we had laughed at while sunshine flooded the rooms became less unreal when we had nothing but blazing fires and wax candles to dispel the gloom. They became more real also when servant after servant left us to seek situations elsewhere, when noises grew frequent in the house, when we ourselves, Claire and I, with our own ears, heard the tamp, tamp, the banging, and the clattering which had been described to us. My dear listeners, you doubtless are utterly free from superstitious fancies. You pooh-pooh the existence of ghosts and only wish you could find a haunted house in which to spend a night, which is all very brave and praiseworthy. But wait until you are left in a dreary, desolate old country mansion, filled with the most unaccountable sounds, without a servant, and no one save an old caretaker and his wife who, living at the extremist end of the building, heard nothing of the tramp, tramp, bang, bang, going on at all hours of the night. At first, I imagine the noises were produced by some evil-disposed persons who wished for purposes of their own to keep the house uninhabited. But by degrees, Claire and I came to the conclusion the visitation must be supernatural, and Martindale, by consequence, untenantable. Still, being practical people, and unlike our predecessors, not having money to live where and how we liked, we decided to watch and see whether we could trace any human influence in the matter. If not, it was agreed we were to pull down the right wing of the house and the principal staircase. For nights and nights we sat up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, Claire engaged in needlework, I reading, with a revolver lying on the table beside me. But nothing, neither sound nor appearance, rewarded our vigil. This confirmed my first idea that the sounds were not supernatural. But just to test the matter, I determined on Christmas Eve, the anniversary of Mr. Jeremy Lester's disappearance, to keep watch by myself in the red bedchamber. Even to Claire, I never mentioned my intention. About 10, tired out from our previous vigils, we each retired to rest. Somewhat ostentatiously, perhaps, I noisily shut the door of my room, and when I opened it half an hour afterwards, no mouse could have pursued its way along the corridor with greater silence and caution than myself. Quite in the dark, I sat in the red room. For over an hour, I might as well have been in my grave for anything I could see in the apartment. But at the end of that time, the moon rose and cast strange lights across the floor and upon the wall of the haunted chamber. Hitherto, I had kept my watch opposite the window. Now, I changed my place to a corner near the door, where I was shaded from observation by the heavy hangings of the bed and an antique wardrobe. Still, I sat on, but still no sound broke the silence. I was weary with many nights watching, and tired of my solitary vigil, I dropped at last into a slumber from which I was awakened by hearing the door softly opened. "John," my sister, almost in a whisper, "John, are you here?" "Yes, Claire," I answered. "But what are you doing up at this hour?" "Come downstairs," she replied. "They are in the oak parlor." I did not need any explanation as to whom she meant, but crept downstairs after her, warned by an uplifted hand of the necessity for silence and caution. By the door, by the open door of the oak parlor, she paused, and we both looked in. There was the room we left in darkness overnight, with a bright wood fire burning in the hearth, candles on the chimney piece, the small table pulled out from its accustomed corner, and two men seated beside it, playing at cribbage. We could see the face of the younger player. It was that of a man of about 25, of a man who had lived hard and wickedly, who had wasted his substance and his wealth, who had been while in the flesh, Jeremy Lester. It would be difficult for me to say how I knew this, how in a moment I identified the features of the player with those of the man who had been missing for 41 years. 41 years that very night. He was dressed in the costume of a bygone period. His hair was powdered, and round his wrists there were ruffles of lace. He looked like one who, having come from some great party, had sat down after his return home to play at cards with an intimate friend. On his little finger there sparkled a ring. In the front of his shirt there gleamed a valuable diamond. There were diamond buckles in his shoes, and according to the fashion of the time, he wore knee breeches and silk stockings, which showed off advantageously the shape of a remarkably good leg and ankle. He sat opposite the door, but never once lifted his eyes to it. His attention seemed concentrated on the cards. For a time, there was utter silence in the room, broken only by the momentous counting of the game. In the doorway we stood, holding our breath, terrified and yet fascinated by the scene which was being acted before us. The ashes dropped on the hearth slowly and like the snow. We could hear the rustle of the cards as they were dealt out and fell upon the table. We listened to the count, 15-1, 15-2, and so forth. But there were no other words spoken till at length the player whose face we could not see exclaimed, "I win. The game is mine." Then his opponent took up the cards, sorted them over negligently in his hand, put them down together, and flung the whole pack in his guest's face, exclaiming, "Cheat! Liar! Take that!" There was a bustle and confusion, a flinging over of chairs, and fierce gesticulation, and such a noise of passionate voices mingling that we could not hear a sentence that was uttered. All at once, however, Jeremy Lester strode out of the room in so great a hurry that he almost touched us where we stood. Out of the room, and tramp, tramp, up the staircase to the red room, where he descended a few minutes later with a couple of rapiers under his arm. When he re-entered the room, he gave, as it seemed to us, the other man his choice of the weapons. And then he flung open the window, and after ceremoniously giving place for his opponent to pass out first, he walked forth into the night air, Claire and I following. We went through the garden and down a narrow winding walk to a smooth piece of turf sheltered from the north by a plantation of young fir trees. It was a bright moonlit night by this time, and we could distinctly see Jeremy Lester measuring off the ground. "When you say 4-3, he said at last to the man whose back was still towards us. They had drawn lots for the ground, and the lot had fallen against Mr. Lester. He stood thus with the moonbeams falling full upon him, and a handsomer fellow I would never desire to behold. 4-4-1, began the other. 4-4-2, and before our kinsman had the slightest suspicion of his design, he was upon him, and his rapier through Jeremy Lester's breast. At the sight of that cowardly treachery, Claire screamed aloud. In a moment, The combatants had disappeared, and we were standing in the shadow of the fir plantation, shivering with cold and terror. But we knew at last what had become of the late owner of Martingdale, that he had fallen not in fair fight, but was foully murdered by a false friend. When late on Christmas morning I awoke, it was to see a white world, to behold the ground and trees and shrubs all laden and covered with snow. There was snow everywhere, such snow as no person could remember having fallen for 41 years. It was on just such a Christmas as this that Mr. Jeremy disappeared, remarked the old sexton to my sister, who had insisted on dragging me through the snow to church, whereupon Claire fainted away and was carried into the vestry, where I made a full confession to the vicar of all we had beheld the previous night. At first, that worthy individual rather inclined to treat the matter lightly. But when, a fortnight after, the snow melted away and the fir plantation came to be examined, he confessed there might be more things in heaven and earth than his limited philosophy had dreamed of. In a little clear space just within the plantation, Jeremy Lester's body was found. We knew it by the ring and the diamond buckles and the sparkling breast pin. And Mr. Cronson, who in his capacity as magistrate came over to inspect these relics, was visibly perturbed at my narrative. "Pray, Mr. Lester, did you in your dream see the face of the gentleman, your kinsman's opponent?" "No," I answered. "He sat and stood with his back to us all the time." "There is nothing more, of course, to be done in the matter," observed Mr. Cronson. "Nothing," I replied. "And there the affair would doubtless have terminated. But that a few days afterwards, when we were dining at Cronson Park, Claire all of a sudden dropped the glass of water she was carrying to her lips and exclaimed, 'Look, John, there he is,' rose from her seat, and with a face as white as the tablecloth, pointed to a portrait hanging on the wall. I saw him for an instant when he turned his head towards the door as Jeremy Lester left it," she explained. "That is he." Of what followed after this identification, I have only the vaguest recollection. Servants rushed hither and thither. Mrs. Cronson dropped off her chair into hysterics. The young ladies gathered around their mama. Mr. Cronson, trembling like one in an ague fit, attempted some kind of explanation, while Claire kept praying to be taken away, only to be taken away. I took her away, not merely from Cronson Park, but from Martingdale. Before we left the latter place, however, I had an interview with Mr. Cronson, who said the portrait Claire had identified was that of his wife's father, the last person who saw Jeremy Lester alive. "He is an old man now," finished Mr. Cronson, "a man of over 80 who has confessed everything to me. You won't bring further sorrow and disgrace upon us by making this matter public." I promised him I would keep silence, but the story gradually oozed out, and the Cronsons left the county. My sister never returned to Martingdale. She married and is living in London. Though I assure her there are no strange noises now in my house, she will not visit Bedfordshire, where the little girl she wanted me so long ago to think seriously of is now my wife and the mother of my children. Thank you.
My name is Sarah Jane, and I will be reading my poem for you called Nightmares Before Xmas. And Xmas is spelled X-M-E-S-S. It refers to the messiness around preparing for and gathering for the holidays. There is a heavy importance placed upon having the perfect decorations, gifts, and food to create the perfect setting at your holiday gathering. But all those things are superficial and tend to cause more stress rather than evoking the emotions of peace and joy that are associated with the holiday season. People are hyper-focused on the material things that comprise a traditional holiday gathering, and often forget the most important reason for gathering with loved ones: authentic interpersonal connection. Then comes the Xmas. We gather with family we haven't seen in a while, and try to avoid any unresolved personal and interpersonal issues with gluttonous traditions, tinsel, and bows. While some families do have authentic connections and holiday traditions that are joyful and meaningful, that is not the case for many people. And I'm one of those people. Back in 2016, I decided to stop having holidays with my family because it was causing me more stress than peace. Instead, I spent holidays peacefully alone or in the company of my chosen family. I finally was able to enjoy my holidays, but received a lot of pity and criticism from people about cutting ties to my family. I wrote Nightmares Before Xmas to express that it's okay to celebrate holidays outside of the standards of society because inner peace and joy is more important than abiding by traditions and expectations imposed on you by others. The only time I see you now is in my nightmares. I wake up screaming, then sighing in relief, waking up to this reality, relieved that it was all just a hard walk through a dream. I've been pitied through the holiday season, without a mother to call, without a family to gather. But with the loss of my mother, after cutting ties to my family, I found something invaluable. I unwrapped something you cannot buy on discount on Black Friday. Something you cannot purchase at any retail store. Something you cannot tie with a ribbon or decorate with bows. I have peace beyond an image that's framed on a family Christmas card. I have joy beyond an atmosphere created by glittering tinsel hanging on Christmas trees. They pity me in my solitude, stressfully traveling distance to be in the arms of their families. I hold my head high as I drive through the lights of Christmas Eve with a member of my chosen family, knowing, as hard as it is sometimes, I did the right thing. I have solace in knowing that to have a peaceful life, to have a healthy family, I had to leave the one that I was born into to create my dream family. One I create every day on my journey. With kids, I will create one day and love more than anything once I've healed. I ask those who do not understand, pity me not, for I am free.
the justice in this world. The wicked make so much noise, mother. The righteous stay oddly still, with no wisdom. All of the riches in the world leave us poor tonight. And strength is not without humility. It's weakness and untreatable disease. And war is always the choice of the chosen who will not have to fight. Ave
to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Today's show was centered around J.H. Riddle's A Strange Christmas Game, which I read, and also stories and poems by Sherry Cohen, Julie Rico, and Sarah Murphy. The music we heard starting from the beginning, Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters singing Mele Kalikimaka, then Zee Avi singing No Christmas for Me, then Too Many Zoos, spelled Z-O-O-Z, performing Funky Christmas, Krung Bin, Christmas Time is Here, and we just finished the beautiful Ave Maria by Schubert, featuring Bono and Pavarotti. Big thanks to Sarah Murphy for helping me produce this show. Merry Christmas. Have a great year.
Ooh.